Good morning. But I'm going to talk about something different than what most of the conference has been about. And I'm assuming that you are not in education writing research papers on education. This is people in other areas who also teach, and you can write education papers as a hobby or on the side, and it won't make you any money, but it may help get you promoted, and it can help in other things. Okay, why do you want to do this? Well, there are nice altruistic reasons for doing it, and there are career reasons for doing this. You really can help improve education in your discipline, and you can share your effective teaching ideas. For personal career reasons, it does help integrate teaching with the rest of your life. And I honestly think that publishing education papers has helped the adoptions of my textbook for a couple reasons. One is I am more aware of the pedagogy of writing the textbook. So I think it's a better book. Plus, if I go to a school and talk to them, what I find out is that the professors teaching the course, if they're not using my textbook, they don't understand what's in the newest edition. Their idea of what's in the book is two editions old. And it's a different book. So I can tell them that, and often I'll get them interested enough to get a copy and take a look at it. I don't know about other areas, but in engineering, the best time to bring in a new book is when enrollment is down, because then they have time to look. Otherwise, when enrollment is way up, there's no time, and they keep using the same thing over and over. If that's my textbook, that's fine, but otherwise it's a problem. Okay, so why should you listen to me? Well, I've been through all this. I'm an editor of Chemical Engineering Education, which is the nice green. I have a textbook, Separation Process Engineering, and I wrote the history of our chemical engineering department when we had the 100th anniversary. And that particular one was a book for hire, which made sense because I think it sold on Amazon. I think they've sold something like 22 copies. Because we gave away several hundred copies, okay? We had a big celebration, 500 people, everybody got a free copy. We get it back in donations to the department, okay? So that's the idea. Okay, disciplinary educational journals. As far as I can tell, almost every educational method in college has an educational unless you get down to some really small sub-discipline of a sub-discipline. But if you're willing to say bigger. Now, I've listed the engineering education journals, but there's also history, health, art education, college teaching covers all disciplines, and so forth. And we'll come back to this, but there is also this Kennesaw State University. For some reason, they've decided that they will list every possible education journal. So if you're not sure what's available, you can go to that website and find out. So lots of options. Now, if you're interested in promotion and tenure, where you publish is important. That in engineering, we have first tier, we have second tier, we have a journal that is, this is, happens to be the Civil Engineering Journal. It's either second or third tier, depending on how you look at it. We have a journal that is entirely online now. Now, a lot of people think online means lower quality. Not necessarily, but it's probably not going to be considered first tier unless somebody's done a lot of work to explain that they really are high quality. And the other problem with online journals is that I think that because there are journals that are predatory, people tend to downrate all the totally online journals. None of the journals I'm going to talk about are predatory at all. They're all legitimate. We also have conference proceedings. There are 1,300 to 1,500 papers in our annual conference. Most of them are published and then ignored. Okay? They're all available free online, but if you want something to be cited a lot, the Journal of Engineering Education, which only publishes about 30 papers a year and has about a 10 to 15% acceptance rate, gets many more citations. But it's very hard to publish it. Whereas the conference proceedings, everyone is reviewed. The reviewing is very erratic. Some of the divisions, it's really easy to get in there. And some of the papers are really good, okay? I mean, just because the reviewing wasn't tight doesn't mean it's not a good paper. And some of the divisions are real tight on accepting. And then we have, this is our magazine, and it is not edited. I mean, it's edited, it is not peer-reviewed. I wrote a column in there. We had 54 columns over an eight-year period. More work to do one page for a column often than to write an entire research paper. More people read those columns than any of my research papers, and I get zero credit for them. Okay? That's just the way research universities work. But name recognition is very helpful. Okay, so I think this is true of most areas in education. There would be like a general history journal, and then there are subdiscipline journals, American history and European history and so forth. There are electronic-only journals, as I mentioned. They can be high quality. They can be predatory. There are magazines, which if you need publications for promotion and tenure, I would be very careful about that route because they tend not to be peer-reviewed. Educational proceedings that I have had one paper that is relatively highly cited in proceedings. One. It won the best paper award out of 1,300 papers, okay? And that's the only one that's been heavily cited. Whereas I have a lot of papers that have been in the other publications to get more citations. So, when we go to, in engineering, when we go to a meeting on promotion and tenure, somebody will have their laptop and they will look up the number of citations you have or the person that we're discussing. So it comes up all the time. On books are not included in the Science Citation Index. They're not included in Scopus. So even though the books can have several hundred citations, they're not going to show up in what people look at. I know of one textbook that has literally 500,000 citations, but it doesn't show up in Science Citation Index or Scopus. Okay, here's the bottom line. If you're interested in promotion and tenure, do they count? And the answer is maybe. Okay, that's honest. Now, we have at Purdue a Department of Engineering Education, and their educational papers count, and they are expected to do rigorous educational research. We also have people in chemical engineering and mechanical, and if you want to get promoted to associate professor in the mainline departments, the educational papers aren't going to help. If you want to get promoted to full professor and you have a lot of papers or you have a book that has been widely adopted, it will help. So things are kind of turned upside down. For research universities to be promoted to associate professor, you need research. To be promoted to full professor, you need impact nationally or internationally. And that impact can be in education also. Now, if you are at a two-year institution or a undergraduate-oriented institution, I would think that it's more likely the educational papers will count, but you got to go find out. It will vary with different schools. Do they help sell textbooks? I don't have hard data, but my belief is absolutely. that they do. And I think it's because of, one, I write a better textbook, and two, people think that it will be a better textbook because I published the educational papers. Okay, I'm an editor. Here's what I want from a education paper. You don't need research grants. You don't need a TA. You don't need a research assistant. You can just do an education paper as part of your regular teaching. You come up with an idea. You want to try it. You try it in class. You get a bit of data. And then you can often publish the paper. So the first thing, of course, is have something worth saying. And in order to know if it's worth saying, you need to look at the journals in your field, okay, and find out what they have. Study recent issues. There has been a upgrading of educational papers in almost all disciplines following Boyer's 1990 book. It's been slow, but a pretty steady upgrade in what is expected. So if you look at old papers, they're going to probably give you the wrong idea. You want to be within the last couple of years. And then one of my big complaints is read the guide for authors. If you read the guide for authors and you follow it, the editor will be happy. You want to make me happy if I'm your editor, okay? Because I make the decision. Okay, outline. You know, and much of this is just like writing any paper. You outline it, and the reason for doing that early is you can see where you don't know things. You probably don't have a pedagogical literature review. You probably have a literature review in the area, but not on teaching in the area. And I send papers back to people if they don't include pedagogical literature review. Because how do you know if it's novel, if there's something new, if you haven't looked at at what else people have done? Do you have a question? She wants you to.
Yeah. What's the standard if you're writing a book chapter, for example, and you want to see some of that information published sooner, you want to take it to a journal? What's the ethics and what's the procedure for approaching that?
Okay. I'm going to talk about this in a minute, but if people do a proceedings paper, which is a similar sort of thing, yeah, I understand. But we have a rule for proceedings papers because it happens all the time, that we want enhancement. If they've done it in a conference and had a proceedings paper, we want about a third of the paper to be different. Now, you're talking about the reverse situation where you're going to publish and then do the book review or the book chapter. I think that it's if I get it first, what you do afterwards is your business, okay? Because I'm first. It's the book chapter people you might have to worry about, of whether or not there's too much overlap with what you've already published. You know, the first one out is the one that feels that they have the rights in that.
Yeah.
Well, what you have to check is also copyright, and we will let you take and put the material anywhere you want as long as you basically cite us, okay? So you got to follow, you know, normal rules on copyright and on if you're going to copy verbatim, you got to show that. If you're just paraphrasing, you would mention that and so forth. So I don't think it's a big problem, but the other thing is that different areas have different ideas on what is okay and what is not. You have to get your own discipline. How many people here are familiar with IRB? Well, most people, okay. Institutional Review Board, if what you're doing is you're teaching it in the class and you're getting some data, but there is no way that anybody could tell an individual student from the data you present, the IRB will probably give you an exemption, okay? If you're taking rigorous data and suppose you're interviewing individual students, then the IRB is going to want, they may want a full disclosure, and you got to have protections for the students. Okay, but you need to do that before you collect the data. Now, if you collect data in class for the purpose of improving the class and you're not publishing it, you don't need IRB approval. Okay, you can do that as part of your normal class. When I get papers that clearly have research and they haven't mentioned the IRB, that's a question that they get back before we publish. Do you have IRB exemption or approval? Because it's not, I don't want to get involved with doing something that would be unethical of publishing papers that I know have not met the requirements. Okay, get something down on paper, same as anything, edit and revise. You'd be surprised at the number of people that spell check but don't proofread. Spell check is not a proofreader, okay? You put, if you have a word missing that should be there, spell check will not tell you that. Pull out the guidelines for authors and see if they're followed. Things like, and this sounds picky, but every journal has their own way they want you to reference things. Well, guess what? If you're going to get published, at some point you're going to put it in that format. I'm not going to do it for you. My managing editor is busy. She's not going to do it for you. You're going to do it, and it works better if you do it early. Do not send rough drafts to your editor and say, I'll polish it if you like it. Okay? Editors are busy. You know, I'm a professor. I do the editorial thing on the side. I make $6,000 a year for editing. I'm probably about $3 an hour, okay? Yes? Okay. There you go.
I understand the not sending a rough draft, but how do you feel about people sending an abstract to see if it might fit your journal?
I think it's okay to ask what kind of things do you want. I mean, I'm assuming that you've looked at copies of the journal, and I'm assuming that you've read what the journal says they want, and you have something that it's not obvious at all. It's not in the things we don't want. It's not in the things that we clearly say we want. And so you have a question if there's some interest in it. Sure, I think a short query, but a short query is not a 20-page document. That's
right,
the thing.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, submit it. Most journals now are doing all the submissions electronically. Drives me crazy when I have to submit something of my own, but just, you know, do it. If you get the paper back, I probably send back more than half the papers I get before I send them out for review. I take a look at it and I say, there's no pedagogical literature review. There is no data whatsoever, not even a survey of students, and which for a lot of type of papers we expect. And it clearly says in the guidelines that we expect it. And I'll send it back. I'm actually doing you a favor, okay? Because if you get really negative reviews to start with, you've got a big hill to climb to get published. Whereas if I send it back and you can fix those things before it goes to reviewers, then you can get much better reviews and easier to get published. I'm doing it partly to improve the papers, but partly to save my reviewers. I hate to have to send things to reviewers twice. You know, they get tired. And of course, they're not getting paid either. Follow the editor's advice. If I tell people, please include this, and I get it back and they haven't, I'll send it back to them again. And if they send it to me another time and they haven't done it, I will reject it. Okay? There are some things that if they're not there, I know what the reviewers are going to do. They're going to chop the paper into little pieces. And okay, so paper gets sent to the reviewers, and you get to wait. Okay. Now, here's the thing. On occasion, we lose papers. Not very often, okay? But it is perfectly okay if you think that you've waited longer than is appropriate to ask if there's any status report on your paper. Okay? Because that is a flag for us that we need to check. And, you know, every once in a while we check and we find out that we messed up. And we will then push to get results to you fairly quickly. Usually when things are slow, it's because we're having trouble getting people to review the paper. Or somebody will say, I'll do it, and they don't. And we want a minimum of 2 reviews. We will send it out to 4 or 5 people to get 2 reviews. Sometimes we get 5 reviews. I have one paper, I had 7 reviews on it. I told the person that you will never see this again, okay? But I sent it to 7 because I was worried people wouldn't review it, and they all did. So anyway, you wait, find out what's happening, and you get a response. Editors pay attention to the reviews. Sometimes the editor writes a review. I know a lot of editors, and they say that occasionally, if they're interested in the paper, they'll read it and they'll write a review, which, because reviews are anonymous, you don't know that the editor wrote the review. And then I will read the reviews, and I will basically say which ones I think are important. I might say, reviewer 2's comment 3 is really important. You need to address that. I will also occasionally say, reviewer 3 is off base here. Don't worry about what they say. Okay? Or, reviewer 4, ignore the tone. The person is angry for some reason, but the comments are really useful if you can get past the tone. So I try to normalize what's happening with the reviewers. Okay, I send a letter to you. If I send a letter that says, once you've made the changes in an adequate form, we'd be happy to publish, that's a great letter. Okay? That really is a great letter. People may not see that. What you want is a letter saying, we accept it, we love it. Okay? Rarely, it does happen, but rarely. And I'll get to that in a minute. I'll request revisions, and I may say that I will decide whether or not to send it out for a second review or not. If you make the revisions that I asked for, I'm not sending it out for a second review. Okay, I don't like to send things out for a second review. You may get a letter that says, we're going to send it out for a review again, because I had every reviewer check that box that it had to go out for review again, and I will do that. You may get a rejection that encourages to rewrite, or you may get one with no encouragement whatsoever. If you get one with no encouragement, go to your second choice journal. Okay? Follow the advice of the reviewers to improve it, and then go to the other journal. Life is too short to keep beating on the same place. If you get a rejection, go into Word, not email, and write a letter about what you think about the reviewers and their parentage and so forth, okay? And do not send it. And then after you've calmed down, you can go back to work, okay? I mean, you know, I send things out my own, and every once in a while the reviewers don't understand. And they send what I don't understand is how 3 separate reviewers cannot understand, but it happens. Okay, how do you respond to reviewers? This is true. Every once in a while, every reviewer will say, this is a great paper, accept it as it is. I've had that happen twice in 20 years of editing. So it may happen, but don't count on it. Okay. So the reviewers can be really insightful. I have, on occasion, totally revised an article of mine based on what reviewers said, or they can be dead wrong. They can disagree with each other. And incidentally, if they disagree with each other and you don't want to change, that's a great argument for not changing. They can be complimentary. They can be nasty. Okay. I have thought about whether or not I should sometimes just not send a review to people, but I send it and I basically say that you got to ignore this part of the review. They can suggest a lot more work. And you may not want to do it. And so your best argument in that case usually is, but it will make the paper way too long. Most editors do not want hugely long papers. Every once in a while, they will make a comment that you look at it, you say, how could I have missed that? Well, the thing to do is fix it. Okay, if the editor will tell you which parts the editor thinks are important, remember, the editor's making the decision, so if you follow the editor's advice and fix things, then you're highly likely to get published. I would never, if a reviewer is wrong, don't change it to the wrong way, okay? You write a short note of why that reviewer has made a mistake. If they're correct, change it. If they tell you, and it took me a long time to get to this point, but if they say that a sentence or a paragraph is hard to understand, it's hard to understand. Okay? And you, maybe not to you, but there was an intelligent person that could not understand it easily. And you got to rewrite. Okay, what I want is I want you to try to improve the paper. You don't have to change everything. If you change 75, 85, 90%, including typos, which of course you're going to change, I'm probably going to accept it. Okay. If you change nothing, if you disagree comment by comment by comment, and I have seen people do that, I have to go with my reviewers and I'm going to say no. So, you know, because you got to try to improve the paper. And what I want is the author work with me to improve the paper. I want common courtesy. You would not believe it, but every once in a while we will get somebody who literally cusses us out, okay, that will not help you get published. The managing editor, in that case, blocks their emails, okay, because that type of behavior is just not acceptable. If the paper was presented, I mentioned this, if it was presented at a conference, and this is the second publication, be honest, cite your paper, mention it was at a conference, and we now require, and our journal is part of the American Society for Engineering Education, and it is their requirement that we not just take the paper as it was presented at the conference. I can reprint. If I have an award-winning paper, I will reprint, but it will be clearly labeled it's a reprint, not a new publication. Got to have about a third change. You got to check with the journal what they want to do with conference papers. How about citing your own work? I cite my own work, but what I'm saying is, don't overdo it. If there's a paper that's kind of out in left field, and there are five papers out there that are all in the same place, and only one is yours, and you only cite yours, you know you've overdone it. You really shouldn't cite any of them, probably. Okay. Slight difference is a book on teaching. teaching in your discipline. I have a second edition of Teaching Engineering. It is the most widely adopted, partly because there's only one competition. Okay? This is not an area that will make you a lot of money, but it is an area that will give you a lot of name recognition. Okay? And the second edition just came out. We have this is a textbook for students taking a course for PhD students on how to teach, so that people preparing to become professors. And there is a SkyPack, an edition that's available on the web. And Brady Kolb in the back of the room there, if you raise your hand, is a SkyPack representative. The thing about it is $10 for the student, almost giving it away. And so my feeling, on the SkyPack, I opted to take no royalties on that one because I wanted to get it out to people that would be useful to. And of course, but I could take royalties if I wanted to. Okay. Questions? Oh, she just wants me to go back two slides. Okay. Now she needs me.
When you, as an editor, how do you, first of all, identify people? I presume you're editing in engineering journals. So how do you, you're in chemical, how do you identify people in industrial or mechanical to review papers?
I usually don't. I am an editor for chemical engineering education, so most of the papers are written by chemical engineers, perhaps somebody in a related field like environmental, but usually chemical engineers. The way I pick reviewers is first I look at what references they have. Who did they cite? And if they, have cited people that have written in chemical engineering education in particular, then I will, even if I don't know them, I'll send them, ask them to review it. I will also, if you have just sent me a paper 3 months ago and you have anything to do with this, you're probably going to be asked to review it because your paper you haven't heard yet and you feel that you have to review it if you want to get this. And so, but I'm not the only one. A lot of editors do that, okay? I also have reviewers that I know of particular areas pretty well, okay? I have reviewers that I know all they will do is comment on the English. But if the English needs comment, that's okay. All right? So I have reviewers I overuse, and the managing editor says, no, you can't do that, okay? but I always send her, she actually sends out for the reviews. So I send her more names than she needs. Other questions? Wait.
If one does research, survey research among a professional community, is there some kind of IRB hoop associated with that, or because they're adults, is there nothing required, or are there any things we have to be concerned about with regard to using that data?
Now, if you're not doing it in a university setting, okay, IRBs are located in institutions as far as I know. And so if you send a survey out to people that have graduated 20 years ago or something, I actually took a paper I was doing on a survey of graduates to the IRB, and their response was, I didn't need to do that. Okay. So I don't know if it was because they were not at the institution any longer or because they were adults, but I was told there was no need. Whereas if I do it with Purdue students, I have to at least get an exemption.
This is an organization not even housed in the institution, in the college.
If it's a professional organization, you probably do. There's probably no IRB that's responsible. And so you're probably okay. Now, the other thing you want to make sure of is that you don't do things in a way where I could identify that, you know, you're a particular person who responded in a particular way. So you, now, when we did the survey of graduates, actually the IRB said that I should not actually do the management of the survey. I had a secretary do the management, so she knew who responded, who did not respond. She knew which person had responded to a particular survey, and I never knew. So if you never know, then you can't, you know, say something you shouldn't. So.
If you survey an organization that has 300, the organization has 300, maybe 500 people in, who are members, you get responses back from only 35. Is that publishable information or not?
Well, that whether it's published or depends on editors and the review. Now, I have read that if you are, that you want to aim for 40 or 50% response. The problem with really low responses is it a good sample? It's really hard to tell if you don't know who they are, whether or not you got a good sample of the 300, 400 people. So is it something that really does represent what the sample is?
A lot of that depends on your field, because epidemiology, they want to see 80% response.
Okay.
Marketing research, they're delighted with 10% or 14%. And the average for that type of consumer response is 0.05. It's 0.5% response rate. So it can go all over.
Yeah, but there's a difference. Marketing is not being published, they're using it for other purposes.
Right, but you'd still want it to be representative.
Yeah, you
but
still want it to be
so
representative.
It's interesting.
Yeah. But the accreditation agency in engineering used to require that people got responses from graduates on how well their education prepared them for their jobs. They stopped doing that, I think partially because people were getting response rates that were too low, and they didn't mean anything. So now you can get a higher response rate. What we ended up doing was calling people or sending them personal emails. You don't send a bulk email. You basically copy and paste, and each email is targeted to an individual person with their name in the salutation, and your response rate will go up. Not hugely, but it does go up.
I have a question about, I just wanted to clarify your role as the main editor of your magazine. When papers come in, do you read them all, or do you automatically then just send them out to reviewers? Or do you ever reject some without going sending them to
reviewers? Oh, I skim them to start with. And the problem that a lot of educational journals and disciplines have is people who really don't know what it is, they want to get a research paper published, and they'll send it to me, and it's inappropriate for the journal. And at that point, I will just tell them, this is not appropriate for my journal, and if you want to send us something, read the description of what we want, okay?
It looks like it might be appropriate. They just go out to reviewers then.
Well, I will send papers back, even if I think they're appropriate, if they're missing things that will help them get accepted.
That's right.
Okay, yeah. So I don't read it completely, but I will read. You know, I'll skim through it and read it. I read every paper that gets published because I'm proofreading the journal, okay? But that's quite a bit later in the process. Now, we have a couple other editors also. I'm probably doing more than half, but I'm not doing all of the papers that come through.
So I just want to clarify, and this might be a really dumb question. So after it goes out to reviewers and the reviewers put their comments, and you write the letter to the author saying we accept or reject mm-hmm. or, you know, revise and resubmit, whatever, do you actually read the paper then, or are you basing your comments on the reviewer's comments? How does that work?
Well, sometimes I will read the entire paper. We get papers that I have to depend on the reviewers because it is on an area of chemical engineering that I don't know anything about. Okay, there are within the curriculum, there are courses that I have never taught, I am not capable of teaching, but they're important, and there are people that write about those, and I must depend on my reviewers. If they write in an area that I am pretty aware of, I can usually pick out fairly quickly whether or not it makes sense. Okay. So the answer is it depends on whether or not it's an area I feel very comfortable in.
Do you have any reviewers who are trained in educational research, or are all your reviewers chemical engineers?
Well, I have some chemical engineers who are trained in educational research, okay? The majority of our papers are not research papers. For example, people will write about developing a new course. Okay, that's very valuable because if you want to develop a new course and people are doing this in areas other people are interested in, seeing what somebody else has done and having a pattern to get you started really is helpful. But it's not research.
Sure. And so the ones that are more on the research end with analyzing the student data, do you steer those toward those who are trained in both engineering and education research?
I will split. I will send the paper to people trained in educational research, and I will send it to people who are not, because it has to be understandable to the bulk of my audience, which are not trained in educational research. So the educational research papers actually have a harder time because they've got to satisfy two audiences. It's not that the acceptance rate is lower. It's not. But they end up working harder to get it. Paper that will fit. And then they work really hard, and it's not unusual that they win the best paper award, which surprises them because they had to do so much work to get it published. But it's because of the tour audience factor. We automatically include every paper except for papers that an editor was involved in when we look at for best paper. So I cannot win the best paper award, which I think is appropriate. Okay. Okay, I'm going to move along here that I actually have I'm perfectly willing to spend a little bit of time working with people individually if they want to work on this. The goal is to get you, if you're interested, get you to the point where you would finish the paper on your own. Okay, we have 15 minutes. And I know not a lot of people might be interested in hearing the general talk, but they don't want to sit down and actually do any work, and that's fine. We're going to take a very short break, give people who don't particularly want to work on a paper a chance to take off. And I'd be happy to spend the last 15 minutes working with individuals and providing whatever information I can. And I'll just very quickly show you what I have is find a target journal and, I went the wrong way. basically figure out what you need to do in order to have a publishable paper. And I think I can probably help with that, even though you're not in my area. I think the education journals are generic enough that there's not a problem.